team. I just accept that honorable time. I said this is not the quality, but I'm engaged. But you will join us as soon as we arrive in the parliamentary message. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to request the honorable members of the committee to nominate the acting chairperson, and thereafter the chairperson will take the seat and proceed with the presenting of the name. Over to you, honorable members. May you please nominate the acting chairperson, Honorable Mafia.
The name of Al-Gibir is proposed.
Honorable Didier, may you... Okay, thanks. Honorable
I nominate Honorable Masubeda, and I take a second.
I think Honorable Lee's proceeded early. We will be encouraging you to consider your nomination, because Honorable Bozer has already taken it. Thank you, Honorable Lehmann. This question is completed. Honorable Didier, may take a second.
Thank you, Honourable Members. Election day 8.5, 50 minutes past 6. You voted. But only this side of the house. So what is so democratic? Yeah. But if you're there. Thank you, Honourable Members. Let's get our work done. All the time is quite with delay because of Des Pock at Guantambo International. It's not only his flight, it's a couple of flights. It was supposed to leave at 6 o'clock this morning, that couldn't take off. But he will be here about 11:30. Departure was 20 minutes to 9. We've got three presentations that is on the table. First, are there any apologies, Secretary?
Thank you, President. I have got a written apology from my Honorable Bloom. That's the only apology that I have.
On the Bloom's apology, it seems to me it's a permanent apology from all finance appropriations meetings. I put you to the committee members. Welcome, Honorable Mashile, from Pumalala, where the sun rises. It's an apology on the table, Honorable Members. Can we accept it? Thank you very much. Welcome to the different organizations, stakeholders that will make submissions this morning on the division of revenue. To divide revenue, you have to collect revenue. Otherwise, you are stuck. And it's a very important exercise, collecting the revenue, reading the proposals as captured in the speech and budget review document of National Treasury and the speech of the Minister of Finance. And it's our duty, Honourable Members, it's our duty that we go and explain this to our people in our constituents, it doesn't matter from which political party you come, that they understand where does the money come from and how the money is divided and what route it takes after that. And our role as Parliament to engage extensively and robustly with the ministers, departments to monitor the spending, etc. With that short introduction, we will call on Salga. Salga, representative is here. Sir, you can come to the front to be closer. We call this inner circle the business class. You can come and sit, yeah? Yes. We're going to give you, according to the agenda, 20 minutes. I'll extend it. I'll make 25. Very generous this morning.
Thank you very much, sir.
25 minutes to make your presentation. Honourable Members, do you have the copy in front of you? There it is. Sir, you may proceed.
Thank you very much, Secretary. I've got in keeping the cost containment within the economy first. Thank you for the invite. So, thank you very much. I'm sure I will comply with your time requirements. I think firstly is to make the point that the SAGA welcomes the overall sentiment of the division of revenue. Given the current, particularly given the current economic climate, the budget supports the NDP's vision of building a capable state, and through the appropriation begins to give expression concretely to some of the commitments in the programmatic form as contained in the NDP. Also, I urge that the alignment of this 2013-14 budget to the NDC is essential and critical for job creation. It's our view that the budget encourages economic growth, therefore job creation, and emphasizes the need to work with business by creating an environment for business to create such jobs through the policy environment created by government. The targeted focus on infrastructure expenditure will have a natural impact on economic growth, again, therefore, on employment creation opportunities. The call for control of government expenditure is welcome. Is a welcome development in curtailing wasteful expenditure. The drawing trend on local government funding notice. The point we're making. My apologies, I was not talking to the point. The controlling trend on local government funding is noted. We do take the view that the challenges faced by the local government sector in particular do warrant a contrast slope, in other words, a upward slope to what we're seeing as a story of funding on local government. I guess that might be best addressed maybe not through the division of revenue process, but through the broader fiscal discussion around the fiscal environment within the month of the of our government. The impact of the new local government equitable share formula is welcome, particularly that it introduces a sensitivity to municipalities with lower revenue raising potential, and we're noting that 50% more is as a result of the new formula allocated to rural and district municipalities. But also welcomes the new human settlement capacity grant in the order of 300 million rand with six metropolitan municipalities. A number of municipal grants have had funds shifted to their indirect components, or the new indirect grant components created over the spending period. Additional amount of under budget 934 million added to the indirect regional park infrastructure grant, and this is naturally welcome, together with the incentive introduced for developing more integrated and efficient cities through integrated development grant in the order of 841 million rand over the medium term. I think what this grant in particular does begins to, in a very concrete way, acknowledge and contribute to the role of the big cities in stimulating national economic growth and development. And then additional funding is made available through a subsidy of 293 million aimed at lowering the cost of basic services, and we're noting there that they can continuously work that seeks to quantify the aggregated cost of the provision of basic services. Then an amount of 36.1 billion rand will be transferred to municipalities through the direct to direct conditional grants, and 7.7 billion rand will be spent on their behalf through indirect grants. The increase in indirect grants in the 2014-15 period is noted, and this makes up 17.6% of the conditional grants to municipalities compared with the 14.3% in the previous year. Funds were reduced from municipalities with weak past performance, something the order of 460 million is shifted from direct integrated national electrification program to an indirect component. Further notes, in addition, from its first to failed implemented in projects, the funds may be converted to indirect grants for national governments to provide infrastructure on their behalf. However, the caution that we sort of raising here is that whilst we need to strike the balance between the spending of allocated or appropriations to the budget, we need not at the same time be oblivious to the absolute requirement of ensuring that through the spending of this grant allocation, we allow municipalities the opportunity to develop their own internal capacity to spend on this. So yes, the movement to an indirect component is important to ensure that we spend the allocation, but we need to not lose sight of the impact on skills transfer and retention within the local government. Chair, these figures are in your document. I'm not going to speak into the table. That's very evident. In the, just make the point that the human settlement development grant and the urban settlement development grant both have exceeded general capital spending by the metro in particular. And furthermore, that the UFDG, the urban settlement development grant, performance is improving in the 2013-14, and that this will be a more, on a more solid ground heading into its fourth year as a grant. And then the 2013-14 expenditure reported 93%, with the Buffalo City Metro and Mangaroo Metro managing to improve their spending over the past year. And to focus a little bit on the two grants, the Human Settlement Development Grant and the Urban Settlement Development Grant, the USDG increases by 13% in the 2013-14 compared to a small 1% increase on the HSDG. Given the estimated inflation of 6.2% in 2014, this effectively means that the Human Settlement Development Grant in real terms is in decline. Combined with the recent potential increase in the housing subsidy approved by MINMEC, this will put considerable pressure on the Human Settlement Development Grant and limit the sector's ability to meet the targets for the delivery of the structure. So what you have is almost a double-edged sword, one that the quantum of the grant is being decreased, and then we have an increase in the subsidy, which obviously means that the CSW will be able to effectively spend less or spend on less housing units, that is, or other output. In the USDG this year, SAGO will be lobbying the National Housing Department, the National Department of Housing, and putting together proposals to extend the USDG to additional larger cities. And the point I made here just, earlier is that the USDG begins to make an acknowledgement of the role, the critical and central role of the big cities, the metropolitan big cities, in driving national economic growth. And therefore, the grant is an important instrument to consolidate that endeavor. And therefore, SAGO will be looking at introducing a range, or lobbying to the National Department to introduce a range of the bigger cities outside of the metros into the scope of this grant. SAGO is also working with the National Department of Housing to amend the existing housing subsidy programs to enable the application of backyard dwellers, as well as to develop other possible initiatives for municipal support to backyard dwellers. And then to continue on the U.S. The Human Settlement Capacity Grant, the new Human Settlement Capacity Grant will provide something out of $300 million funds directly to six metros who have now been or in the process of being signed the housing partial in 2014. And the funds are intended to cover the operational costs to administer the National Housing Program on behalf of government. So this is a grant that goes directly to the devolution of the housing function in the metros from the provincial Department of Housing. The National Department of Housing has indicated that the HSDG capital grants will only flow directly to the prime metros from the beginning of July 2014, which leaves a full year for the metros to utilize the capacity grant to get their housing order. So the capacity grant will be able to create the institutional arrangements within the metros to optimize spending on the capital component of the grant once the function is transferred in 2015. And in order for Metro to be ready to receive the grants by the July 2015, the driver is the provincial department, where many of the staff that currently undertake that function, and they will quickly provide full information on staff assets and projects that are to be processed to the metros, and to work with these metros on what we refer to as an integrated detail, if you like, of the imminent handover of those projects. And then the National Department also set out a clear plan to provide detailed technical assistance to each metro throughout this year and ensure that the national accreditation platform functions effectively to enable clear communication and support for the program. In summary, it's extremely important to that the risks in many of the metros are not set up to fail and to ensure that there is no depth in performance, both financial and non-financial performance, when the end of the function happens. Then on the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant, the RHIG, RIG if you like, since its inception in 2010-11, this grant has struggled to perform. of the 205 men allocated in class 13 as indirect federal vehicles, only 135 million, if you like, 66% of the grant was actually spent. In Calgary, they welcomed the conversion of this grant to a direct grant, to 5D grant to municipalities in 1340, and extended the capacity, capability, rather, and accountability of local government to deliver onward and transition services to households. Municipalities can better manage community consultation processes and are able to choose the appropriate technology. Shift to direct grants means the same sphere which installs infrastructure is then responsible for the ongoing maintenance and functionality of the infrastructure provided. However, difficulties have remained in the 13-14 with rollout despite the conversion to the direct grant. In the period 2013-2014, 112 million allocated as direct grant. But at the end of quarter one, the 30th of September 2013, the recorded expenses of zero. Chair, again, this is just a reflection of the performance of the grant from 2010 and projected up to 2016-17 financial year. The dual approach to the grant introduced in 2014, Division of Renewable, may therefore be an appropriate solution to ensure that service delivery while simultaneously centering and promoting local government's role in the provision of sanitation services. 42% of 48 million will flow directly to municipalities upon approval of business plans, while the remainder is spent directly by the National Department of Housing by service level agreements with the municipalities. Departments must also provide a field structure as part of project implementation. But after years of the Millennium period, ideally the entire location will be dispersed directly to municipalities at the special central 5B grant. Then, Chair, we move to conclusion just to raise a few matters which have a cost implication for local government for the committee's consideration. The Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act was expected to come into full operation towards the third quarter of the calendar year. Its implementation will lead to an increase in operational budgets for municipalities, as they are now required to establish municipal planning tribunals. And these planning tribunals must be composed or appointed staff of qualified and experienced personnel to serve on the planning tribunal, and the point I made that the Act is expected to come into operation during the course of the 2014 financial year. Now, to give full effect to the provisions of the Act, municipalities are required to undertake a number of processes, amongst others, the review of the spatial development framework, the town planning or zoning scheme, and they are required to prepare new land use scheme. That will also require a review of policies, bylaws, systems of delegation, and they are required to put in place necessary record systems or record keeping systems. The process of land use conservation also has a cost implication. Average cost of a high court application sits in the order of about 80,000. So any conservation that the municipality pursues at cost is borne by the municipality, like the initial planning tribunals. The appeals tribunal will also have cost implications. Qualified professional staff must be appointed in terms of that to adjudicate on the appeals act. And then the fourth point is the point of making that the cost implication will vary depending on the extent of existing capacity and the system currently in use in this metro. So if you look at national features, the metro should be much better equipped to implement the full requirements of the Act, but it's the district, the small municipalities, which are going to find difficulty in implementation. And then on the regulations on appointment and conditions of employment of senior managers, the regulations now prescribe that municipalities must review staff structure by the 16th of June 2014. The staff structures include at least the following departments, development and town planning, public works, effective services, you have them there, And this obviously will have a direct cost implication to value. Because the assessment must be done for all municipal managers and Section 56 managers will also have a cost implication for this value. And then on the Public Administration Management Bill, the bill has recently been passed by Parliament and will have financial implications for municipalities. There's currently no indication of whether costing has been done to date, or if it has been done, well, not yet, despite requests for this transparency. The bill will provide significant, in fact, Act now provides for compatibility of ITC systems. Now, the exact extent and the cost of this compatibility and or integration is unclear, but that the requirement is in the Act. And it follows that if municipalities are going to be expected to bear the cost, it would have a significant impact on municipalities. Then, of course, presentation before the committee will be complete for start of admission of unfunded mandates, unfunded or underfunded mandates. The point that we make, or we emphasize, if you like, is that the unfunded mandates are a significant problem faced by local government. And the point, I think, that we've been emphasizing that they can be minimized if parties involved properly adhere to legislation around their financial functions. The National Treasury, we suggested, should review the extent of compliance with legal procedures of the department and delegation of functions. And it is important to develop minimum norms and standards to guide the provision of municipal services. Now, let's just put this into context for you separately. If you take a metro that is undertaking ambulance services, which is currently a provincial service, is undertaken by the metro. Currently, by way of example, a metro has 50 ambulances in operation in its area. And the province is only funding 13 of those ambulances. The question is the metro over-providing the service, or is the province under-funding the service? So the province says, in terms of our norms, we are only funding you for 30. And if you provide anything above 30, you must fund it. Now the municipality is faced with this choice. It either reduces the level of service, it reduces 20 ambulances to 13 ambulances that is provided and funded for by the province. Or it continues to provide that level of service and pays for the service. Now, and that's how we're making the point that it's important that we develop a set of uniform national normal standards to guide what level of service should the fine function be provided at, and therefore that the concomitant costs are duly appropriated to the implementation. City of government being local government. And then the provisional assignments should be done through a formal agreement as per legislation. The lack of agreements contradicts both the legislation or contradicts legislation, including the constitution. The MSCs for finance and municipal councils must monitor the implementation of formal agreements, preferably through service level agreements between councils and municipalities, through provincial and municipal budget benchmarking. The MECs for finance should ensure that the fine functions are completely budgeted for, that the provinces and allocations are granted, and that the transfer is actually materialized. Because often the commitments that the municipalities will undertake a function, these allocations are not granted. So some way through the financial year, the province or the department responsible runs into financial problems, and then reduces what is then deferred to the municipalities. The municipalities would have already committed to spend on those functions. So that if they're not exempted and the transfers materialize, it creates a problem for municipalities. And then to move towards the boundary redetermination, we know that there's a process that will result in the number of municipalities in both the KN housing provinces will merge. The merger preparation process will be starting during 2014, already in order to ensure smooth functionality for the municipalities on day one, presumably sometime in 2015. Past experiences emerging from 2011 measures indicate clearly that there is a dire need for the establishment of a dysfunctioning class. Again, if I can draw attention to the example of Sonia, I suspect it might be an exception, but it's an important case study that the municipality failed to fund out of its own coffers. As you see, something in the order of 1.5 billion to offset the cost of it. Now, this is part of staff systems integration. And this payment of service providers incurred prior to the merger. And I think, as you speak, the cost increase 1.5. The province during the 2011-12 allocated 50 million there. And that is the extent of how that merger is defined. Now, the point is that there's a whole range of cost implications that come about as a result of merger. These need to be much fully identified, and there needs to be an indication of how the receiving municipalities are going to be assisted to offset or mitigate those costs through some kind of function. And then to move toward from conclusion, Jefferson, the municipal revenues will certainly remain under pressure in the 14-15 financial year. Require great involvement of organized local government in the budget process, or the continued great involvement of organized local government in the process. The budget process is acknowledged, and SALGA will continue to increase its efforts to participate qualitatively. We continue to participate in the review of the local government fiscal framework, including processes linked to the local government infrastructure grant review, a review of municipality own revenue sources, and then of course the project that looking at the provision the cost of providing the basic services. So that is sufficient.
Thank you, Mr. Polite. Honourable members, please note down your questions to SALGA. We will take the second submission, submission by the FHC. Also welcome Commissioners Tanya and Maria Price and Professor Streisler. The settlers farming between Botla Ray and Calder Watch related to their Danish interests.
I was just going to say that
I'm going to thank Senator White. Well, yes, you've got clients in the room, so now I know this famous very well from many years ago. Like a day when you last know. We're just waiting for the FSC to get themselves ready. Yes. The battle of ideas. I referred to that in my speech last week when we dealt with the fiscal framework, World Economic Forum. How often you can take this note, Salga, do you sit with the FSC regarding unfunded mandates and with the National Treasury? Because those things are coming on since I'm in Parliament in the provincial legislature in the Northern Cape quite a while ago, and we're still talking about the same thing. The battle of ideas. This is what that just makes me nervous. Mr. Kumalo, welcome with your whole team, and the assistant is eligible for us, and you may proceed.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members, for the invitation to come and brief you on the position of the revenue bill. I just want to maybe introduce my colleague that I brought here. I have Commissioner Nico Stasher, Commissioner Tanya Ajam, and then I've got Sasha Peter, and then I've got Eddie Vargas. I've got Ali Daoud and Mr. Head. It is a very big team, but my whole Cape Town office is here, including the commissioner. So the only one person that came from Johannesburg.
People will make you strong.
Yes. So, let me just start off by putting a context to this submission. It's made in terms of Chapter 13 of the Constitution, 214. 2141 and 2142 of the Constitution, and also Section 9 of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act. I think it's important that I put that background because there's one or two things that I want to raise that basically relate to the nature of the recommendation and the response that the Commission has actually got in terms of its recommendations that the Minister must respond to in line with the requirements of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act.
But the submission basically is looks at specific comments on the division of revenue bill and then looks at a range of other areas that we thought were important to touch on. But I think in terms of the division of revenue bill itself, I will allow Ezra Gabbard to speak a little bit more in detail around that. But there is basically what we noticed is that there's basically five changes that are significant, and we welcome the changes that have been made there, especially the issue of increased accountability for transferring officers, which the Commission has raised in the past, and also the issue of looking at the whole design of the grant system and trying to introduce an incentive structure to the grants. We think there's quite a significant movement in that direction, although there's still a lot of work that needs to be done going forward around the actual design issues in the grant framework. We also welcome the issues around incentives towards supporting integrated cities. I think the Commission's recommendation is around about 2011 basically emphasized the need to rethink the way in which our cities are actually developing. So we can see that there's quite a significant movement in the direction. However, probably unlike Saudi, we are actually very skeptical about the issues surrounding indirect conditional grants. We actually think that whilst the premise that on which this is based is basically to suggest that spending happens if it's a national department that's actually responsible for it, it's probably a myth because it's not borne out by facts. Now, we need to, and we have had this discussion with the National Treasury, and we have agreed that in this current work cycle that we're going into for the 2015, going to the 2016 division of revenue, we will actually be tabling some recommendations. We will conduct some work to look at whether or not this move, because it's quite a significant move, growth in the share of indirect conditional grants as opposed to direct conditional grants. And obviously there are certain implications for the whole system of conditional grants, even though it's under review at the moment. But there was quite a huge growth in the number of direct grants, and we don't think that's the right thing. It's actually reversing changes that were introduced around 2003, which basically were dealing with this whole problem with indirect conditional grants. So we're seeing a return to that, and there's probably some issues that need to be raised around that. Now, having said that, Chairperson, I must also indicate that in terms of the response of the Minister of Finance to the Commission's recommendations that were tabled in May last year, we have had quite a number of discussions between ourselves and the Commission and the Minister in terms of what he should respond to, because when the Money Bills Amendments Procedure and Related Matters Act was introduced, we had some discussions around how we then restructure our submission to respond to the issues that are required in terms of that legislation. And we ended up agreeing to simply, as a Commission, to simply put all the recommendations in one document. And unfortunately, it becomes quite complicated then for the Minister to deal with those other issues that are not related to the provision of revenue bills. So we have agreed with him that in terms of the Intergovernmental Fiscal Relations Act, he needs only to respond to those recommendations that relate directly or indirectly to the provision of revenue bills. But we've also highlighted to the Minister that the Commission's recommendations are also made to Parliament. And so ultimately, Parliament will have responsibility for
looking and following up on those recommendations that have not been qualified and into our findings. That's how we think this whole issue should proceed going forward. So we don't have any serious issues with the way the minister responded, but we think that there are some recommendations that are quite relevant, especially those that relate to the fiscal framework. So that's what I wanted to say up front. I must say that before I allow Ezra to speak, with respect to some of the issues that have been raised by SALGA, especially the issue on the unfunded mandate and the issue of SWAN, we are actually doing some work with that, and we are going to be finalizing a report on the issue of SWAN. The aftermath of the measure that happens with the city of Sonny. We need to get the documents that we require from them, and we'll be finalizing that, so we'll be sharing that with the local commission. If you may, so can I have that?
Thank you,
Mr.
Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
If you allow, I will do take you through that part of the presentation, and Ms. Peters will do the local government part. So, this table, I think we all this is just an indication of the division of revenue between the different spheres. The major thing to note there is that we continue to see the moderate budget growth, and this is in line with the Commission's recommendation around budget contributions that was made in this previous submission. So I wouldn't spend too much time on this table. Let's see. The 2014 budget maintains the momentum of fiscal restraint from the 2013 year. Again, what we see in there is that the share of revenue still, the bigger part of the revenue still goes to national government. What we also noting is that the share of provincial government has been growing steadily over time, now currently sitting at 43.3%. The overall, the provincial allocations for the provincial allocations are rise upwards by 10 billion rand, and 23 billion of that goes to the provincial allocated share fund, suitable share, and 6 billion allocated to conditional grants. Similarly, local government received an additional allocation of 4.5 billion, and 1.9 billion of that goes to conditional grants. The major addition in the provincial equivalent share for this year goes to the inflation related salary adjustment, and the Commission in the previous submission made several recommendations around managing the provincial wage bill. Again, there is also a considerable amount of money that is allocated to power infrastructure to accelerate delivery of hard water and sanitation. That has been reported by the nature of the budget, and by the look of things, it may very well be necessary again to increase this allocation in light of the disaster that we see in Limpopo and the West, the current when we look at the provincial fiscal framework overall, we noted that the provincial fiscal framework inclusive of all the conditional grants is revised downward by 20 million then when you compare to the 2013 medium term budget policy statement. But again, this is not to say that the provincial allocation and decline is just that when you're making the comparison, we know that the difference. The bill proposes an increase to the provincial vegetable share funding from about 389 billion rand in 2014 to 362 billion rand in 2014, again to fund the higher wage costs. Conditional grants for the other hand are projected to grow by only 2%, the unannounced in terms to fund the blood damage costs in the first half of the year of 2015. And also looking that there's a new OSP grant to fund the education services. Again, the issue is about the management of this OSP grant, as we have seen previously, how the problems that emanated when OSP was implemented, especially in provinces like Limpopo. Chairperson, last year, again, the equitable share formula was reviewed with the users of data in Russia, and there because there was a lot of movement around the migration from migration between provinces. So several provinces experienced a decline in the allocation because of the movement of the people from one province to another, especially Eastern Cape and Limpopo province, and also the most west province. But that week can actually be dealt with through the changing of the political share over a 3 year period to minimize the impact of that movement. So in the Commission's view, it's a welcome development. With respect to conditional grants, the Commission notes the decline in other types of conditional grants, which has been performing very badly over the past period. Again, the caution there is that this reduction should be made in consideration of the impact it will have on food security, especially because the levels of poverty are increasing, and also when these grants like your agriculture are advised for those kinds of outputs or outcomes to be considered. Lastly, with the provincial conditional grant, there is a new conditional grant which has been introduced for fast-track market eradication and housing in the mining towns. And the conditional grant funded mainly through the reduction in the Indian settlement development card and the Indian settlement development card. So the issue for the Commission there is that the grant is welcome, but again, the Commission wishes to caution the effects of this reduction on the delivery of housing. As we have indicated previously in our website, the amount of subsidies, of housing subsidies, are insufficient to address the scale of the housing. So when this reduction is made, again, the trade-off, the potential trade-off between funding and the service delivery should also be considered. And more importantly is that the old is still new and relevant policies should not be replaced with new ones. So in the case of market eradication, this has been a priority for government over a period of time, but there has not been any movement to eradicate the market system. So what we know is what we see is that the new country is being introduced without taking consideration of what has been the failures of the past instrument to address the same problem. So the question there is that when introducing the new country, we need to consider what the past lessons and learn from it and design the plan in such a way that it will be able to achieve the objectives that it is to us. There's also need to ensure that capacity exists to ensure better work to be done with appropriate grant framework, including exit strategy and design plan. Chairperson, if the mission can ask Ms. Sasha to take that over with the local government and we'll conclude the presentation.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair, members of the committee and other colleagues. Turning now to municipalities, we note that with respect to the local government fiscal framework, the equitable share allocation amounts to 167 billion over the 3-year 2014 MPF period. Conditional grants increased from 34 billion in 2013 to 36 billion in 2014. And given the significant service delivery responsibilities allocated to municipalities in terms of Schedule 4 and 5 of the Constitution, the Commission welcomes these allocations, the improvements to these allocations. Actually, in addition to progress with respect to regional equity among municipalities, which in addition to progress with respect to revenue equity among municipalities, which the revised REA tax was closer to, the Commission also feels that there are other objectives that are equally important, things such as financial and technical capacity, including certainty and accountability, and of course the effective service delivery. With respect to financial and technical capacity building, the view of the Commission is that we need a greater level of coherence and synergy between attempts aimed at this type of capacity building, particularly when we consider the numerous amount of capacity building conditional grants and intervention such as your LOMESA. In terms of stability and certainty, we see adherence to the medium-term expenditure, the concept of a medium-term expenditure framework very important. Whilst we acknowledge that policy reprioritization is part of the public policy process, the Commission is of the view that any shifting of focus should aim to be as smooth as possible and not to disrupt good performance. In terms of accountability, the Commission welcomes the strong focus on eliminating corruption, and we've seen a number of municipalities improving their internal controls and fraud prevention techniques have been strengthened. In light of the increased pressures on local government revenue sources due to increases in costs associated with higher demand for service delivery, the Commission welcomes the review of own revenue sources that is currently underway, and we note that in addition to this review is also the review of local government infrastructure conditional grants. And the Commission appreciates the approach that the review takes in as far as it involves all key stakeholders, the National Treasury Sphere, leading us that involves SAGA, ECOG, FSC, etc. But we are of the view that persistent challenges such as the unfunded mandate issue mentioned by SAGA, as well as continued uncertainty over powers and functions within the local government sphere, particularly with respect to functions of districts relative to local municipalities, these types of challenges will serve to reduce the full impact that the reviews aim to achieve. According to Budget 2014, the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant will be divided into two components, the direct and indirect components, with the indirect components being aimed at those municipalities that lack capacity to implement sanitation. And given that this grant targets rural municipalities that lack implementation capacity, the Commission would advise that the allocation in terms of the direct component be based on an assessment of the capacity required within the recipient municipality, just to ensure that the municipality is actually capable of successfully implementing this grant. As you know, capacity constraints are not new. They continue to hamper the ability of local government to fulfill the service delivery mandate. And the Commission has raised this on numerous occasions. We would suggest that government consider a review of capacity building grants and programs, looking specifically at their design, the implementation, and the outcomes attached to them. We are of the view that the results of such a review can serve to enhance coordination amongst the different capacity building interventions. One new conditional grant has been, local government conditional grant has been established in 2014, namely the Human Settlements Capacity Grant, and it's in recognition of the assignment of the housing function to Metro. Now, given what we raised about the lack of synergy amongst the various capacity building interventions, the Commission has emphasized the need for coordination and synergies of this new intervention and various existing capacity building grants and interventions. And then finally, with respect to the local government sphere, the Commission welcomes the National Treasury-led review of the local government infrastructure conditional grant. And what we think is key with respect to this grant, which will be taken on board, is the need to look at the issues of governance and capacity when it comes to these infrastructure grants. Chair, I'd like to hand back over to Eddie just to take us to my chairperson.
Just a quick one, Citizen, on government's response to the Commission's recommendations. Like I've already indicated, it's not all the recommendations that we responded to. It's roughly 8 of the 13 chapters we responded to. But I must say that is the result of a very intensive consultation between the National Treasury and the Commission's Secretariat in terms of growing in on what would be considered to be directly related to the division of revenue or indirectly duties or related. So that discussion I've already spoken to. Can we move to the next slide? So I think in the next slide, basically what I'm trying to do there is to highlight the fact that there are recommendations that are accepted. There are recommendations where government responds in the manner of saying there are already existing interventions in place. Now, what we have noticed in the past is that increasingly stakeholders keep asking what is happening to those recommendations. And what we would like to highlight in terms of this particular submission are those issues that I've listed. The one is on the effectiveness of the function budgeting groups, the FET turnaround strategy, and the reining in of the government wage bill. Those are issues that have been highlighted as issues that are already on the table. And for us, it would be important that Parliament actually monitors that and ensures that those responses actually speak to what is actually happening. And then an important aspect of the consultations that take place between, because our consultations normally take place between ourselves and the National Treasury. Now, we are not in direct contact with a number of other departments, and yes, it is something that is very specific. Now, what we have noticed is that when it comes to conditional grants, I think the Commission's mandate is that it must make recommendations on the division of revenue, and it's not just the equitable share. Section 2141 speaks about the equitable share and also the grants. Now, there's a lot of grants that actually get introduced or get stopped or get all of those things just happen. And the Commission is rarely consulted around that. In fact, what tends to happen is that probably in January, we then get a documentation from the National Treasury that then tells us that no, there are these grants that are being proposed by this department or by that department. And at that time, or at that stage, the process has gone so far that it becomes almost impossible, because for the Commission to actually work on anything in terms of the FSCS, we need 90 days in terms of the FSCS. So there is no way we can actually work on something that we get in January and be able to put in recommendations that are effective, well-informed, that should be tabled with the budget in February. It's impossible. So what we are trying to do, because in our recommendations we had actually indicated that between ourselves and the National Treasury, we need to ensure that when departments propose these grants, those are actually shared. So it is that discussion is taking place between the National Treasury and the Secretariat of the Commission, that we haven't elevated that discussion to the level of the Commission. I'm just raising this so that the community actually gets aware that when we raise some of these issues around this conditional grant, we're not just mourning about something. We are actually speaking to what is in the Commission's mandate, what is required in terms of the Constitution. So, Chairperson, let me then conclude this presentation by saying the Commission welcomes the overall draft of the Division of Revenue Bill. It has contributed to promoting future growth, but moderation and sustaining cost spending. So that we do not see any cuts in what we consider to be cost spending areas of government. And that basically is something that we should be welcoming. We also welcome the fact that there has been in the process this year, if you want to set the budget review, a real attempt at matching budgets to the key pillars of the National Development Plan and aligning budgets in that manner. That basically is something to be welcome, because it shows commitment and credibility also of the budget process in responding to what has been agreed to as direction that South Africa must move towards, which is the National Development Plan. Also, we the Commission welcomed the idea of setting expenditure things as proposed on NMGDP and also condemned in the budget. Now, these ceilings, however, must be set through an evidence-based process. So there's a starting point for everything, but we must actually, in retrospectively, try to look at what the impact in different spending areas of those expenditure ceilings are, because sometimes those expenditure ceilings might actually result in unintended consequences. But I think the general direction is very much welcomed. I think finally what I can talk about is that there is concern from the Commission's viewpoint over the growing trend towards indirect grants. The need for systematic interventions to address poor performance rather than simply shift control of grants from one sphere to the other to try and deal with the issues of implementation failure. And then we as I've already indicated, we've agreed with the National Treasury that the Commission will make this part of its work in this current year for tabling of recommendations in 2015. Chair, let me end here. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Kumal and your whole team for those who assisted you in the presentation. It will be very interesting to make an analysis on the money spent since the transformation of local government on capacity building programs. It will be billions of that. What did we put in, or what did we get out? Referring to your center, the general failure of capacity building grants. And when we met with the local government fraternity in the NCP, the local government week, this was on the agenda regarding the training of officials in local government, especially councillors, on understanding the MFM and the implications of the MFM, what's expected to be. So it all fits together. I don't remember if you want to take questions, but first, Salga, the gentleman with the police got an appointment outside this town, he can fly there. But just a caution, Mr. Lay, in future, don't block out the whole day, because your flight might be delayed or anything else that happens at the lower number. So when coming to Cape Town, block out the whole day, even the evening, to a much sooner. Other members, questions? We recognize Honourable Monsisi, he also arrived when attending another meeting dealing with mandates, so the members will be in and out assisting other committees as well. Honourable Mashile, Honourable Lees, Honourable Joseph. I believe after the elections there will be a budget forum meeting. Budget Council will have to meet. There will be a few issues the forum will have to address in terms of what we said now in this, in these submissions on the Division of Revenue. Honourable Mashile.
Thank you, Chairperson. There is very little, you know, to speak to from Sal, except that many comments that have come out, they actually amounted to complaints. I'm really not sure because I was of the understanding that in terms of the intergovernmental relations and also the provision of SAR that were to take up its positions in the NCOP and they should be able to interact left and right. They will be able to interact left and right with any government structure, Treasury, FSP, whatever, you know, all these things so-called unfunded mandates or whatever. Really, I think those are too much open, and there are many these doors that they can walk in and engage and can interact. And because I mean, there is a free of the flow of information to the municipality in terms of the allocation, the budget. And really, one believes that these are not the things that we can get from SARPA, because surely they are better off to interactions with government and with all the structures that are required to make sure that the local municipalities really do their work in time. And the planning of projects, the staffing, everything, I think in terms of the MCEF, surely these municipalities can have problems. Even if the funds are going to be sent to these cities on the 1st of July, but these cities know that this money comes back. Fairly speaking, they know that the money comes, and they know the conditions under which this money comes to them, and what they are expected to do. And surely you can't really have a problem that then they will still be dealing with issues of capacity to actually prepare them from the 3rd of July. I don't know, but all what I'm just simply saying is that Salga and the municipality have got too many doors that are open for them to interact in time and influence and clarify and make sure that everybody understands their situation and take appropriate actions in time. But of course, we will continue to repeat that the sooner they do actually take the position in the SOP, and then so that when we deal with some of the people that are actually influencing their work, they are there. And then that may make their life a lot more easier. Because currently, the manner in which they are doing that, they only come here when we have invited them and come like other visitors in Cape Town. I mean, it doesn't have people. They're supposed to be with us, and surely some of the challenges. They're supposed to be providing answers rather than depression to government. I think that's all what I really can raise with the government.
Thank you, Mr. Kamatien.
Thank you.
I'm with FSP on this one. I would think that your constituency would be fighting against the indiscriminate increase of the indirect costs. And so I'm surprised that you're actually sending a mixed message to each of us here today, because sometimes you say they came in, not very good. RHID has failed of indirect grants. So there's a bit of a mixed message coming from you, but there's a principle here that we need to establish, or you need to establish. The question of backyard dwellers, I'm not sure what you're proposing. They're tenants. What are you proposing then for backyard dwellers, which might be different from what is currently being done? You can't give away someone else's property or expropriate it. This whole question of capacity is one that just goes on and on and on as I'm going to see this. But the devolution of the function to metros is kind of a paper thing. I mean, metros have been dealing with housing as agents for a long time. So why suddenly now is the need for capacity building? This thing really changing factors from what's been happening up to now. Are you not concerned? I mean, the rural household infrastructure grants is kind of worth less than half from 2012-13 to 2013-14 according to your graph. I can't remember the whole draw myself, and I assume your figures are correct. I mean, it remains very, very relatively low compared with 2011-12 and 2012-13. Is Helga happy with that? Just the quantum, let alone the lack of capacity to spend. I'm not sure I understand why there should be a change. You're suggesting that the implementation of the land use, or whatever it's called, act, whatever it's called, will result in additional costs to your member municipality. But the fact is that there have been zonings for hundreds of years, and contraventions have happened, and contraventions have to be dealt with. Of course, we know that in recent history, contraventions are not dealt with by and large, and that illegal structures are put up all over the country, and municipalities either don't have the will to deal with them, or don't have the expertise, and mostly, I think, will. When one looks at the people who simply ignore the law. But I don't understand why there's suddenly now an extra cost burden there, just because the legislation is changing. Okay, slide 12 deals with appointments and so on, and a minimum standard in terms of departments. It's all very well said there's a cost implication, but I assume that Selga has actually done a costing and is able to say to National Treasury or wherever they wish the funding to come from that this is the cost of implementation for this municipality, because a general statement, I think I'm fully in line now with what Honourable Mashida said, it actually gets us nowhere to make a generalized statement that it's going to cost. Okay, how much? Which municipality? What are the costs? Can we alleviate those by more efficient operation? The PAM bill, similar thing. We've got problems with it, but what happened during the promulgation of that law, that whole long process, were submissions made by Selga? What was the reaction to your submission? Did you lobby political parties? How did you deal with it? I mean, it's now an act. A very bad act in our view, but it is an act. And I heard much from Selga during that process. You know, the old thing about unfunded mandates. I mean, even as a comforter, I actually hear the cry, and I say, why do you take on the function? Not your function. Why do you take it on? Ambulance is not your function. Say goodbye, ambulances. Go back to the supposed to look after you. Why do municipalities take on functions that aren't theirs? And then come and cry about it being unfunded. It's such a simple solution. Just say, who's doing it? Can you imagine if the Department of Defense said to Simpopa, you take over the function of defense from the national department. Simpopa would say, no, that's not my function. Why do we do the damage? I mean, I get to boggle to my mind. It's been 15 years I've been a public representative, and this thing keeps coming up, and I keep saying, give it to the functionary. Let them deal with it. Stop crying about unfunded mandates. But I'm thinking of Selga thing. Again, it's the same thing. Boundary changes, mergers, and it costs money. How much? Surely an analysis has been done of the merger between Mchezi and Babatan, between Ndaka and Mnambiki Ladysmith, and we know what it's going to cost. And we're putting forward proposals for the funding thereof. But you simply come and say it's going to cost because it's only cost 1.5 billion. Well, SFC said analyzing was only one. But has Olga analyzed? Can Olga tell us why it's not 1.5? Does it need to cost 1.5? How can we cut those costs? You see, Chairman, I think Honourable Mashida and I agree there's kind of a generalization here and it's impossible for me to deal with. I can't deal with it. I see the specifics. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. I would like to start off with Mr. Selga, making the point that you acknowledge the topic of skills. As the reasons why the municipality is not able to perform or complete implement the project. My question to Selga is what the proposals have you made specifically on trying to improve that situation? Of course, we hear it also over and over, the sort of skills at the level of municipalities. I haven't heard anything about, and I'm not too sure if asking the question and correction about the IDP, monitoring also capital allocations to improve the IDP and the part of municipality. On the panel, I think it's important to have a look what is the costing. Interesting point you're making about IT systems and the responsibility that's almost going to be shifted to you, and that may give us an opportunity to allow you to plan for it. But I think it's important if you're able to tell Parliament what in your view, what is the cost going to be for the IT systems, the fact that if the panel comes in that responsibility. Is an important part of municipalities of function in terms of the IT system, but also the costing of the transfer of skills, which points down to the transfer of staff. You know, you need that information to understand the impact of the PAMBO on municipalities. And then the unfunded mandate, I just wanted to take it a step further in terms of what my colleague is saying. Or maybe bring a solution to say, just send an account to the province for the work you are doing, that they owe you money. In the intergovernmental relations, there must be that talks of these services that you provide as unfunded mandates, whether it's the library or the ambulance services. There must be some agreement that you must send them accounts that they owe you some money, because there's a lot of money in the province is not spent. On the FFC, Mr. Chair, I just wanted to make two points.
Thank you very much. I think let me make a point that I don't think there's a single forum that's available to SAGS, including the representation in the NCLT. Summer is not visible. So we participate in the budget forum. Much of what we've raised here has been raised in the budget forum. I think what we are saying is that a number of issues that have been raised were addressed through this forum. So what we're raising here is over and above what was addressed through the budget forum, bringing it to the attention to this forum. So yes, we do participate in a whole range across the parliamentary scope of the different departments. But these things continue to affect local government. So we will continue to raise them, because these are the challenges that confront local government. We've been intensively engaged in the process around the review of the equitable share formula, to the point that the formula was reviewed. We know that formula has a much more positive impact on how the appropriation gets dealt with in terms of the equitable share formula. But these problems, sure, we can dismiss them as complaints, but these are the things that affect local government. SAGA is constitutionally obliged to raise them. And yet, I think the point is fair that raising them is one thing, but raise them with an intention of finding solutions to these things. And I want to commit to you, Chair, respect that I think we have made every effort to not only raise the problems, but to indeed raise how we think that it can be resolved. Now, let me maybe deal with some of the individual issues. The housing function, yes, the metros have been in part implementing the housing function, but the reality is that the provincial departments of housing sit with an entire staff structure, all project management units, and projects which they manage currently in provinces, including the administration of the housing beneficiary processes, which in terms of phase 1 accreditation has now been moved to local government. The phase 2, 3 accreditation requires then the municipalities to undertake this project. So it's not a paper exercise with respect. The projects that are currently sitting with the regional professional teams appointed in the province, managed by the province, funded by the province, with staff of the province, all of that now has to be ring-fenced and transferred into local government. That's why the process is such that in a span of 1 year, linked to the 300 million grant, the capacity to move those functions into local government. The question that we raise here is that if the provinces are not diligent and dutiful with respect to unfolding this process,
it is going to cause implementation problems. Because if the staff is not properly transferred, if the projects that are currently being funded are not properly identified and transferred, you're going to have problems. So it's a caution that we're expressing that the error process unfolds towards 2014. These are the kind of things that needs to be attended to ensure that there's a smooth transition of or transition to level 3 accreditation. I want to make the point in the presence of the chair, I'm sure his colleagues will share. I think if we came across as saying, you know, there's happiness, business with the indirect grant, I think we must indeed clarify the point explicitly. The SAGA does not favor the increased trend of indirect grants. Because our principal view is that the capacity must be created at the sphere of government intended to discharge the function. So if local government is at sphere, we cannot run away from the responsibility of capacitating that sphere to discharge its responsibility. The point that we're making in the presentation, and my apologies both to the chair of the FC as well as the membership of the committee, that we appear to be wishy-washy, is simply to say that whilst we pay principal and primary attention to developing the skill set within local government and those municipalities, we have to disrupt the service delivery mandate. And we're simply doing all this that transition, that possibility. But I mean, we re-emphasize then is that the SAGA is not supportive of the increasing trend to indirect grants. And I think simply as Rajak captures it, that they must create the capacity in the municipalities to indeed do that. Then on the rural infrastructure grants, I think simply no, SAGA is not happy with the reduction of that grant for reasons that I've explained now. And I think we're making the point at two levels. The first is that the initial caution that we're expressing that there appears to be a plateauing of the local government grants, allocation to local government. So yes, we're raising it in the context of division of revenue, the grant process. But the bigger question is a more principled approach to the broader fiscal relations within the three spheres of government than a narrow focus on grants. Because grants is not going to involve the funding, the fiscal problems in local government. There's a broader discussion that needs to be had. But in the context of the fund, I think what we're addressing, and as I say, sort of is not happy. Does not support the increased trend towards the decrease of the grant, particularly the rural infrastructure grant. Now, the implications of the Spatial Planning and Land Use Management Act. The first is that the implications is that currently the municipal planning tribunals are tribunals that are constituted by employees who are paid by themselves to form the normal salary level and council. And I will support officials to those committees, which are part of the municipality services. What the Act now provides is that the municipalities have to create a municipal planning tribunal, which, like in the case of having the development facilitation tribunals, are external tribunals that requires the capacity of competence. So you have to get external your current infrastructure. You have to establish and capacitate these external competences. And that's where the new cost, the over and the additional cost implication comes through. That applies to both the tribunals as well as the appeal tribunals. And as it relates to pastoralization, the current arrangements, both in terms of the national building regulations and also in terms of the planning ordinance and the application of the scheme conservation, land use conservation, is such that a municipality can only provide a transgression notice. So you can simply go to a transgressor and say, 21 days, you have transgressed either the national building regulations, the code, or you are in controversy of the county scheme. And if that transgressor does not comply, the municipality has to go to court to get an order to compel compliance with either the scheme or the building regulation. And because the court pretended, particularly the magistrate court, attended to treat the controversies as some minor misdemeanor And simply that we can get the pain is additional tears or something all of five. And I'm not expressing the caution, not seeking to undermine the decision of the judiciary. But I think the point is that the magistrate's court may issue in terms of the National Building Regulation a demolition order. I've been very hesitant, and there's almost no precedent where the magistrate's court has exercised their power to issue a demolition order. And that now places responsibility on the municipality to go against a high court order for demolition of indoor structures or conservation of land uses. And that comes with a cost implication. And this is the question that we say, that the requirement of municipalities to enforce or to act on conservation is there, but it is dependent on the ability of our courts to support that process. And then the cost, obviously, is that we then require from having to go to High Court to get the High Court orders to deal with those matters. So on the issues that we raise both in relation to the public administration management bill, the municipal delegation processes, all of these, SALGA has prepared detailed position papers. In each of the respective sectors, our working groups have made detailed submissions to the respective portfolio committees on the issues that we've been raising. And I'm sure that for the record, this committee would be quite happy to put those position papers in the position of the committee. But it is the case that when the acts are finally resolved and sent to by president, they have implications on municipalities, much of which will have been raised by SALGA in the discussions leading up to the adoption of that legislation. And what we're now saying is that the fiscal implication of those legislation has to be acknowledged and addressed. Some of it, I think, part of the issue that each of the MFC has been. In the process that culminates in the approval of legislation, there has to be a better scrutiny, political committees to better scrutinize. And I say it with respect, Chair. Sector departments are looking at the sector priority and implication. I think that there's a defocus when sector department looks at legislation. There's a deep focus on what is the financial and fiscal implications of those people basis. That which the inability to bring in the FFC as a factor, the much earlier point, results in them not being properly derogated. And that these implications may be unintended, but these are the implications that we have. I think that's down to the question around the quantification. I think I can't say we've done detailed costing implications, so we can't say for each municipality what is the detailed cost implication. But the aggregated implication is that there's going to be a significant implication on the sector. And that's the point that we'll be raising in the position terms of the quantification of the proposition. Yeah, I guess that applies to the merger question as well. Actually, I think I've in that goes with the response to the question.
I did on the machine we note I recognize on the Chani, I come on the Chani.
I think that was the indicator. In no way that you're saying what Mr. Fidel's raising is non issue. But the question still remains what you are saying. Raising matters and getting issues resolved is two different animals. And my understanding is SALGA is in a position where it can get the issues resolved. Where to get the issues resolved? If a particular piece of legislation is passed, because of implications in municipality, you went after implications and identified the department, done must actually get the entries to make sure that those things are resolved. But that's not what one is hearing. That's not what one is hearing. It's just raising the matter, just ventilating them. Then all of us, we know. But who takes them further? Two steps forward? Nobody. If we've got a report, like as you indicated, that there are certain reports that have been done, if they have come to the select committee here, and then we discuss them, we write the report, then it becomes the resolution of the MCOP. It falls specific department now to end on. But if they are in your hands, then they're waiting for the time that you get some good audience that is ready to listen. But the fact of the matter is, after they listen, so what? So all what one is saying is that Starga has got the most beneficial position in government of South Africa, in that they can knock in every door and actually get things to happen. Like, as honorable leaders indicated, I mean, if you talk about implication to a small municipality in terms of capacity, what is it that you want to be sorted out? So who must do it? How, why can't we walk into that particular department and say, this is what the first year we can see. It will work in this category of municipality. But these small municipalities, you need to do X, Y, Z. We must take intervention. And then you put up the plan that it must be transferred and engage the right person. But we know that. I mean, Saga is now, Captain, I'm sorry to say, Saga is behaving like another NGO. And it's not an NGO. It's supposed to protect the municipalities. It must defend them. And it must make sure that they are always in a better position to deliver services. And hence, they must certainly champion their own. Every day. That's all what one is saying.
I think that is remarks from the honourable member. Are there any other quick follow-ups on the list?
Honourable Chair, I want to emphasise that these are problems, and I'm not trivialising. Please forgive me if that was the way it came across. But I do think that Saga needs to be doing more. And this is either that honourable Sheila did for me as well. I was just wondering about the question, kind of more specific about backdrop realism. I'm curious about what you really want done with these, Mr. Chair. Thank you very much.
Something put, there is an issue on backyard realism, such that the discussion is such that it wants to bring the backyard dialogue into the subsidy system. So if put it differently, the as opposed to a service side and stand in fund development, that the subsidy be applied to enable the formalization of that backyard play. In other words, to allow for, I mean, let's just a minute to explain the background problem arise. I mean, obviously it's a result of inability of housing program to respond to demand for housing. People take up residency in the backyard. And this is a phenomenon that has come over a period of time. So the discussion is first, let's open up the discussion to enable those backyard dwellers to make application for housing subsidies. Not for a housing development somewhere, but to formalize the occupancy in that avenue, like in the backyard of the avenue. So, tantamount to effectively, like, you would have a second dwelling unit, if you like, in planning terms, on the property which is provided for to the subsidy.
You got the explanation. Are you done? Yes. Although members, we are all human. I'm going to rule that we take a 5-6 minute comfort break. Get your cup of tea, come back to your desk if we succeed. Thank you, Mr. Pillay from Sagra.
I'm in the current year. you talked about the design of housing grants. I'm generalizing, but I think you can correct me if I'm generalizing too much, but the problem being with the design of the grants, and therefore the backlog, and not being able to deal with the backlog. Is it really about the design of the grants, or is it more about the demand for housing? And shouldn't we really be looking more at economic growth and reducing the demand for that kind of housing? In other words, putting the power in people's hands to provide their own housing. Is it the FSC's view that under present circumstances, given the limited growth that this is forecast, that there's any possibility of any government ever meeting the housing demand? Is it rental stock or any other design that you wish to? Page 8, you make the assertion, which I think is accurate, about disruptions to existing good performance resulting from shifting our focus. Can you give one example for me of where that actually has happened? And so what that means is one can look at that and say, well, why did it happen? What did we do wrong as an indicator of what we should be doing now? It's with future changes in focus. Mr. Chairman, I feel quite bad, actually. I quite enjoy putting presenters on their toes, but I don't know what to say to the members of the FFC, which is going to make them angry with me and come back hard.
Any other questions? Mr. Gamal, you and your team.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you, Honourable Members. I'm going to respond to one or two of these questions, and then I'll ask Commissioner Hacham to also respond to the other. Let me respond to Honourable Mashile's question. I think when we talk about this recommendation that we are making here, We are looking at the grant system in its totality. What are the responsibilities of different role players in the administration and implementation of this grant? That's the first part, the responsibilities there. Now, when we had the discussions around the particular matter with the National Treasury, one of the issues that we raised what should be the requirements, what should we expect when the national department takes over a grant and it becomes an indirect grant. Obviously, what the national department does must be synchronized with what the municipality does, because if a temporary arrangement, it's not going to be a permanent kind of a solution to the problem. The temporary arrangement, because there is perceived failure, which has been identified as resulting from the lack of capacity in this municipality. So if we look at the grant framework that we have currently, we don't have any exit strategies that are put in the framework as a requirement. When we have done this, when we have put this infrastructure, what next? Who is going to maintain it? How is this going to be maintained? How is the succession and process? How are they going to have it? So that should basically imply that as you intervene through that indirect grant, you must also take responsibility for ensuring that you then realign the municipality's own capacity so that when you leave, you actually leave that thing operation and it's also like already institutionalized in the municipality. So that's what we call for here is tightening the transfer was to ensure that where you have these types of interventions which should be driven by a clearly transparent process of assessment of the capacity, whether it is actually an issue of the capacity in this municipality that is resulting in this failure. And as I said before, I think one of the colleagues who actually asked the question about the rig in total, the trend, it actually has. They were sitting with the National Department and there was nothing. So what must happen? It was us because of that. Now, are we sure that the national department itself will have the capacity to do that? So that assessment must involve assessment both at the national and at the municipality level, because in most cases, national department take over some of these things. They use the same problem, same providers actually that deal with the problem at the municipality. That the municipality is using. So all of those things are issues that are real and that require a tightening of the ground framework. And so that is the context in which we are making this this recommendation. Sandra, can I ask you to respond to the issue on the contingency there? And on the housing.
Let me take the housing one first. The question is, if we have economic growth, wouldn't that simply allow people to engage in self-provision or self-build? The answer is no. Because we have incomplete and exclusionary housing markets that even that actually excludes a gap market. There is no credit product for self-build of a house, but you can get credit, consumer credit with relative ease. So I think there are real problems with markets, but there are also problems with current state provision. So I think that we've done extensive hearings, and the hearings have actually pointed out that our current supply-side model, where you get completely free housing, is unsustainable. It's not meeting the pace of demand, it's not meeting the quality of houses, it's not even meeting the location of where houses should be. So we must first understand what is the demand for housing, because often we find that young people come to the city, they want accommodation. They don't use the same as inner city housing. Whereas, as they've got families, they move further out to the suburbs. So we need to look at alternative senior choices, right? But even if we look at our current housing dispensation, that is not affordable. So if we keep on doing what we're trying to do, given that the backlog now is full, it's the same as it was in 1994 because the backlog has actually been a growing target, right? So what has happened in the case of the housing grant is the policy has changed, right? So policy is now spending more per subsidy. That actually might be a good thing, depending on why the policy has changed. If it's to encourage densification or better quality or whatever, the point that we're trying to make, and which Sharda has also made, is that the policy has changed, but the grant structure has not. And if you change yourself and start to leave and you keep the glass the same, you are basically only going to be delivering off the houses. Right? And those are the type of trade-offs and changes that Sparta is thinking about. Coming back to the contingency reserve. Look, a contingency reserve is meant to be drawn down. Right? So you don't build it up immediately. I think that ultimately economic growth is going to be the main risk factor going forward. Because if you do actually have a proper economic growth, the entire fiscal framework really loosens. It trickles right down to the entire system. So I think that the importance of this growth going forward is absolutely critical. Unfortunately for us, a lot of the growth factors are actually externally determined by the economic
international economic environment rather than my colleague Ian might want to add to that.
Yeah, just to add to the issue of funding related to the land funding, last year the commission did a very comprehensive study on the alternative financing option for housing. I'm sure the commission has also seen the document. So in the report, we've looked at the number of financing instruments ranging from different type of subsidies. So, and this now problem will protect that the funding is not insufficient to deal with the demand for housing. And so, the very principle that we see in the report was such the different people in various housing circumstances require different interventions. So, the current approach of just using a one size fits all approach where the delivery mode is just the RTC house. Needs to be used to take into consideration that some people may actually just want rental units, express units, and also we also propose some measures on how to improve what is currently considered to be in a state, like you have so we can report online a whole lot of things. With regards to funding for the Mazda, the commission also made some recommendations 2 years ago with respect to funding of the Mazda. The current approach is that the municipalities and provinces must make provision for funding of disaster aid expansion. And as we have seen the report that we have done, especially farmers, it's very significant, it's very difficult to make funding provision for that for disaster because we don't know when the disaster is going to strike. So the a whole number of organizations that we made around funding of disasters that are in the recommendation of the CAP. I can't remember the recommendation, but 2 years ago, yes, we have to. I understood well the issue of the, when we're talking about the market eradication, if I understood the question well, I think what we're trying to say today is that market eradication enterprise has been on the agenda of government for quite some time. And there have been a number of instruments and funding which have been targeted for eradication of market, for eradication of the market credit. But we're sitting today again with the red flag, which suggests that the instrument that we have, we may have used, may not have worked or something wrong may have happened. So the intervention right now is to see the new market eradication card. So to avoid the situation where the grant is not going to be spent just like the rural household infrastructure grant, basically what we say is we need to draw some lessons on why the previous instruments that we introduced not why they have not worked, and address the challenges that we have been considered there, so that we can inform the design of this new grant for public eradication and actually ensure that the money is spent.
It's very important for the members, as when it comes to us, as committees of parliament, to engage with the court reports of the provincial departments, but also the provinces. Is monitoring the spending. The staff is going on after the elections to coach the members and the induction after that, what comes after that. The government select committee of finance engaged with the nine provincial treasuries on the fiscal framework in the provinces, but got a picture of spending in the different departments. That's where the appropriations committee comes in after May, to zoom into that. Regarding the spending on the agricultural grant, like for instance the Northern Cape, that's not for food. And it's an agricultural province, except for the IMO in Katoo, Guruma, Cosmos, Bark, Blimazoo, and Yosquet. So that's the responsibility then of the committee after May. A very short one, please.
Yeah, Chair, I think after hearing what Mr. Kumar has said, I'm sure that we should agree with the FSC that this advice, of course, has got an unintended consequence, a very serious one. I really would propose that they actually look at it. If they insist on it, but there must also be, I'm not sure whether I must say it's a corrective issue. Because surely that you remember the incentive scheme on the EPWP. We said indirectly that no, small manufacturing areas would not benefit from that. They have never benefited. They never claimed anything from me for the rest of that, that grant. And it has been taken up by the metros. So it can. One would not like this advice to lead to non-service delivery in the small manufacturing. And by implication, they drive people now to migrate into the city. That's not what we want. And therefore, if a particular grant cannot be taken out by a small municipality because of capacity, then a plan must be devised. If the province has got capacity to do it on behalf of the municipality, but there must be another inline grant that seeks to correct the capacity issue. Otherwise, then we do everything with that municipality until cows come home. And then that should not be the case. And so if you've got a grant that gives the municipality money to deliver the issue, and the municipality cannot deliver, then you must have a replacement grant that deals with challenges that makes that municipality not to be able to pay, while the actual delivery is done by others. Not never just to take the money and then we run with it to Cape Town Metro or to Antwerp Metro. That actually defeats saving delivery to all our people and actually create that problem of in migration to our city, which all of us are having problems with.
On the same conditional grants that is aimed at eradicating bucket system, I just want to know as to whether maybe the treasurer can answer that because I have all my questions here. Whether it's a direct or it's indirect grant, because as it is, we know that in the past, the 1999 euros, there was that kind of a grant. And the municipalities performed badly. I haven't seen a research that talks to that, but I know for a fact that a lot of the municipalities could not meet the deadline in terms of implementation of the bucket system. Instead, the bucket system increased the number of those kinds of challenges. Now, we are back with this grant, and if you look into the Human Settlement Development Grant, you still have got the elements of eradication of target system over and above whatever that we have now that is a grant on its own. I don't know how the two differ insofar as that particular element is concerned, but you find it appearing on both. Now, my question is, in reality, and the FSU can assist here, will we ever come to a point where we say we have eradicated the target system? And I'm saying this in the context of the reality that we don't have a legislation that regulates the continuous mushrooming of informal settlements. And the more informal settlements mushroom, the more this challenge comes up. It's like we are chasing something that we can never reach until we deal with the root cause of the problem. Now, I think that's the question with regard to that. And I just want to share the FSD's view. If in your engagement, we heard this year that the National Treasury is talking about the debt ceiling. But we don't know. So how do they arrive at that? What are the rules governing them to come to the point where you say the debt ceiling? I mean, not the debt ceiling, the expenditure ceiling. Who gives the figure? How do they arrive at the figure? The method they use to arrive at that? And what is your views around that as the FSU? And why expenditure ceiling as opposed to debt ceiling like all other countries we have in Turkey? Not that others are not. I know there are those that are using the expenditure ceiling like they're doing. But you don't know the method that the treasury uses to arrive at those figures. And what happens in a situation where debt goes beyond that sea. The president could be a relevant party to respond, but I'm not interested to check as to whether the LFC did look into that and what is the views on that. Thank you.
I alerted the treasury that they must get them ready to respond. Looking at disasters, one of the members, we always talk about flooding, rivers coming down like now in the provinces north of us. Floodwaters hitting the Northern Cape this morning and will increase to the weekend. The Vaal and the Orange River running into the ocean at Alexanderplein. That's going to have an effect on Alexanderplein, Port Nolens, on the campaign. Looking at disasters that we also note coastal areas and sea disasters. when we engage with the provincial treasuries, we make this clear to them. Northern Cape, Western Cape, Eastern Cape, and Chesapeake. That be added to their budget projections, estimates in the future, in terms of climate change, etc. That's another debate. There were follow-up questions and then there is.
Thank you, Chair. I think Honourable Mashile, from what you say, I actually see no difference between what you're saying and what I say. So we must agree, like you say, we are agreeing that we need to deal with the unintended consequences of these interventions. And I think, broadly speaking, Honourable Chane, your question on the expenditure ceilings. You know, in most cases, the expenditure ceilings are actually decided on a rule of thumb, what percentage makes sense. So in a situation where you've got very little in the form of mountain standards, it becomes quite a difficult exercise. So I wouldn't say that currently that they see there is any, I wouldn't say from where it is. We do support them in our submission, basically we're making a case. But what we are saying is that in retrospect, as we live with them, we should be able to collect information that will allow us to objectively or more objectively determine this. I think you, when I say you use a rule of thumb, you're looking at all your macroeconomic aggregates, and then you're saying at this rate of growth of the economy, what can we sustain around this and around that? And obviously your priorities matter. And so your core expenditure areas, which in this particular case revolve around the infrastructure, job creation, and also the social wage, you need to make sure that those are actually not negatively impacted upon by any changes in the aggregate or the assumptions that you have made as you move forward. But I think it's important that with experience, you are able to retrospectively reassess and make adjustments. So I think that's the only thing that I can say about that. We haven't, because we picked it up in the and during the MCDS process. We then looked at what the budget was actually bringing. So when the budget was tabled, it then became clear that this is now a decision that has been taken. So we haven't been able to make any substantive assessments. But the principle itself basically makes a lot of sense in the kind of economic environment that we're operating in. So the principle is well accepted from the Commission side. But obviously going forward we'll be able to look at the experience and then try to see what the numbers tell us.
Also, just on the expenditure ceilings, I think it's useful to separate between aggregate expenditure ceilings, which is what Oliver Chan is talking about, but also expenditure ceilings on specific input items, like travel expenditure. So I think we're seeing the introduction of those, right? So a couple of years ago, we as the equity started a debate on should we have fiscal rules. And at that stage, Treasury decided that fiscal rules were not appropriate, that it was more appropriate to have flexibility. So now I think the issue is that we've got an expenditure fiscal rule. Generally, an expenditure fiscal rule is more within the direct control of government than a debt rule, because a debt rule depends on revenue, and revenue depends on growth, right? And I think that what my colleague is saying, we just want to try and understand a bit more what are the underlying factors so that we can assess the effectiveness of the rule after. That deals with the aggregate expenditure ceiling. I think that on the input level ceiling, the issue is a bit more problematic, right? Because if you look at the PFMA is not input-based, it's output-based. So it's saying that you're devolving to the accounting officer some discretion over input in return for accountability for output, and then also this is linked to outcomes through the political oversight project. So that's what the PFMA is saying. So if now you are starting to introduce into categories for good reasons, obviously to cut waste, whatever, but we're pointing out that there's currently a disjunction between what is in the PVA and this other approach, which is of concern to us. So I think that, as my colleague pointed out, these are new initiatives, but we need to make sure that there is some sort of alignment in the general approach.
Thank you very much. I think it's got a few issues because if I take everything when I talk, this is too much. But with regard to the indirect grants, I think that was a question that was posed by a number of times. So maybe it's just to highlight the first thing that an indirect grant, there's not just one purpose why an indirect grant is created. There's various reasons why an indirect grant is created. One of it will be because of historical legacy issues. For example, that's how the regional indirect grants actually came into the system. For example, where ESCOM provides some electricity distribution. So where ESCOM provides distribution, it was an indirect grant. The same applies to former water schemes that were administered by the Water Affairs Department, and there's a process put in place to transfer schemes to the municipalities concerned. So indirect grants have been in the system for quite a while, but for the last 3 years, there has been a new drive to introduce indirect grants. Just as a matter of interest, originally the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant was actually introduced as a pilot to actually look at innovative ways and new non-conventional connected service solutions for sanitation. But over time that got converted into whether municipalities got capacity or not. So that innovation part that was originally introduced for never actually happened. But another good example where part of our practice is, for example, where specifically now quite predominant in the health sector, is to pilot the NHI and to see actually how we can get that off the ground. But just with regard to the allocation practice and whether it will shortchange municipalities and provinces without capacity. What happens when it's granted both on a direct and indirect grant component is the mechanism or the allocation criteria used to do that allocation is done in terms of need. What then gets done afterwards in terms of each and every allocation, it then gets determined is that component or that municipal allocation given to the municipality directly or indirectly. So you won't have although in some grants you've got both, the partial allocation given to a municipality and a partial one given to the national, such as the legacy water program. The Rural Household Infrastructure Grant, for example, first the department submitted a list of the projects that needed to be funded without saying what is direct and what is indirect, and they then made it split afterwards in terms of capacity. But then just on the issue about also the disaster funding, although Sanya answered the question quite nicely with regard to the longer term, there's also still a shorter term grant or needed disaster relief grant in the system that's still available for allocation. And what generally happens first is that the needed disaster relief fund is released for needed intervention, and then the more long term rehabilitation costs then get funded through normal budget focus consideration for the infrastructure rehabilitation. So the needed disaster relief fund provinces received $188 million over the 2013-14 financial year, and our government received $246.5 million. And if it doesn't get spent fully, that amount gets returned. But still, both components are still far from being fully spent. So if DCOP gets the house in order and gets the claims so quickly, they can still process it even in the financial year. Then with regard to capacity building grants, I think that was a very nice point that was raised, and it's definitely something that needs to work. And we currently, we started with the current equitable share, where we reviewed it to actually have better impact and more equitable allocation. We're currently busy with the local government infrastructure review, and hopefully after we completed that, we'll also start doing work on how can we reform the local government capacity building grants. Because the reality is, a lot of money has been spent on infrastructure and capacity building grants. It's very difficult to see the actual outcomes. Then the last thing I would like just to focus on is the issue about asset eradication. A very specific question was asked. But the first question that you actually need to answer is, will backlogs ever be addressed fully? And the answer is probably yes, if you can see with a diminishing population, the population remains stagnant. Because as the population grows, there will always be a need for increased service delivery. But the issue about bucket eradication is also quite complex, because why do we have buckets is actually the question that you need to answer. And it's partly due to large-scale urbanization. Often the court says that there's lack of sufficient box. You first need to actually address that challenge before you can actually deal with bucket eradication. In a lot of cases, also the informal settlements have not been proclaimed yet. And so the issue that we need to then deal with is the policy issue around this. And how do we deal with interim services and informal settlements until all the necessary process are put in place? But with regard to the specific question, there's various grants that actually target bucket eradication. The new grant that's been established is the indirect grant. And it will be administered by the Department of Human Settlements, but also in collaboration with Department of Water Affairs for the Gulf site and also the Department of Cooperative Governance. But existing grants have also been reformed where those funds will be provided through the direct grants and indirect grants. For example, the Regional Water Infrastructure Grant that deals with the Gulf will specifically focus on areas that will support the clean sanitation rollout, particularly the Gulf bucket values. Then also the Municipal Infrastructure Grant, it will work with the Municipal Infrastructure Support Agency or MISA, that's working with the municipalities concerned that's got huge buckets, and a lot of the net will then be redirected to water services. But also quite importantly, that program then will determine what are the appropriate solutions for the different municipalities. So it will actually really zone into where the actual problem is, and actually assist in actually getting sustainable solutions. But the Urban Settlement Development Grant portion of that is also earmarked for the bucket eradication. So it's a multi-pronged approach, it's not just one grant that they fund with. But it is something that will remain with us. It's actually something, the bigger question that we need to deal with as Honourable Shani pointed out, is how to deal with large-scale urbanisation and informal settlement upgrading. Thanks.
Thank you very much. Well, I think we'll continue to engage on some of the other issues. But in the interest of time, I'll move to the next item. It is submission by Project Expenditure Motion Report.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and Honourable Members. I would like to introduce the Budget and Expenditure Monitoring Forum, and we also thank you for the opportunity to make an oral submission case. I have with me colleagues from a number of organisations that are either friends of the Budget and Expenditure Monitoring Forum or members of the forum. So I have my colleague David Higa from the Rural Health Advocacy Project, and then my colleague Dr. Evelyn Timmer from the South African National AIDS Council, SANAC, and then my colleague Karen Reeves from the Mosaic Training Service and Healing Center for Women, and she's accompanied by the Shukrisa coordinator, Vivian Mentolawi. So I think this presentation represents over 15 to 16 organizations. So I hope I could take some liberty in taking more than 15 minutes to take the presentation this morning. But we have limited each other to about 5 minutes. So essentially the submission that we have this afternoon is quite comprehensive, and so what we're going to do is really touch on the main recommendations. So one of the key things that as the Budget and Intervention Monitoring Forum that we focus on is making sure that when we look at the division of revenue as well today, that we're keeping our eye on the Constitution, and that really that should be our guiding point in assessing whether or not the allocations between the three spheres of government and within those spheres of government are in line with what the Constitution mandates and holds responsible, which is really the values of social justice and fundamental human rights. Essentially, the budget, as we see it, my favorite thing, is the skeleton of the state. Sorry, I'm Sabrina Madonka, and I'm the coordinator of the Budget and Expenditure Monitoring Forum. It's the state stripped of all misleading ideologies, and essentially it's important to recall that we've been told that the budget will continue to be constrained, with government facing an extremely tight budgetary environment, and of course this has an impact on the division of revenue that we are discussing today. And just again to highlight, and we did make a submission to the joint sitting on finance, is that we have presented an alternative budget speech that shows that there are alternative political and policy choices that governments could face to expand the budgetary environment for the 2014-15 financial year and the medium term. So essentially what we're doing is we're questioning the pie that is being split up between national, provincial and local government, and saying that actually the pie should be bigger. Again, with respect to an understanding of the human rights framework, we're asking two key questions. Is the state spending and generating funds the maximum of its available resources to meet its human rights obligations? And are maximum available resources being used to prioritize reducing disparities and progressively realize the rights under review? And this morning we heard a number of honourable members questioning, particularly that second point about how do we prioritize the reducing disparities when we're looking, when the questions were being asked are skewing grants that will then end up just benefiting the metros or more greater resource metros as opposed to more rural municipalities. So I'm not going to go into detail again over that. I'm just going to draw attention to the recommendations. And essentially, we would like to call on Parliament and this committee to bear in mind the fiscal framework, the Division of Revenue Bill, and the Appropriation Bill. And so I was pleased to hear and to be informed myself of the question around the expenditure ceilings that are being set. Because as the Budget and Expenditure Monitoring Forum, we are deeply concerned about what this has or what the potential impact this is going to have on the delivery of key services. And so, again, it does have to bring our interaction, whether we're talking about the fiscal framework or the Division of Revenue Bill, we must bear in mind what the implications are for service delivery. We are recommending that we revise the current macroeconomic and fiscal framework to ensure that the Division of Revenue Bill can propose a greater role for service delivery by the three spheres of government as guided by the Constitution. And we welcome the focus on corruption and financial mismanagement, and that the strong stance on ensuring that public officials do not engage in business with state. And that we also welcome the Minister's commitment to ensuring that the general recommendations are implemented, but also we call on the use of the NFMA and the CFMA to ensure that the found guilty of corruption are held accountable. So when talking about increasing the size of the pie or the cake, we are cognizant of the fact that in South Africa we need to deal with the value for money questions, wastage, and corruption. So again, this isn't go through. It's really essentially our core recommendation is we're going to be commenting on specific allocations to the provinces versus local government, and although most of our focus is on the provincial level, with a specific interest on health and education and social services. For us to be able to say that in fact there might need to be more funds made available within those sectors of spending, we need to be able to show where the extra money could come from. So this slide really speaks to that, and we could always come back and present to the committee a more detailed submission on this. Essentially what we want to show is that when you look at the current economic policy and how it's, when you're looking at the division of revenue, and particularly when you look at it for the provincial responsibility for delivering health, we don't see funds or the necessary allocations required to deliver on something as important as the national health insurance. And this was a comparison of the 2015 medium term budget policy statement compared to the Department of Health Green Paper. And again, I can provide more detailed research on it. But essentially, as Bent, we're saying that we need more a greater sort of expansionary budget as opposed to one that limits spending. So we're now going to go into the root of our presentation, which essentially for 2014-15 financial year is really a tale of two services. And it's critical that when looking at the division of revenue goal, we're reminded of what are the needs on the ground when we talk about provincial or national or local government providing services. So overall, we have indicated that there are other options government could be pursuing to stimulate growth and employment in South Africa, and potentially that could also provide some other options of how we can deal with eradicating the bucket system, but also looking at broader issues around the rural-urban migration. But also, we've seen that a provincial fiscal framework inclusive of control grants has been revised downward by $200 million over 2014 NTS in comparison to the 2013 overall framework. So in terms of the restrictions or cuts, we can see that there is going to be an impact overall. When we look at health in particular, consolidated health budget allocation will increase on average by approximately 1% or 1.5% in real terms. And this has an effect, which we can show in greater detail, on what the Eastern Cape, in terms of its revenue, sees of the medium term. And what we're seeing there is an average real growth of minus 2.2%. So we are raising concerns about the ability of a province like Eastern Cape to deliver on health. And then again, we see fairly limited growth in education, with an increase in real growth by about 2%. And then social protection, and looking at the sort of component from a child-focused approach, that again, expenditure towards social protection and social services is again also very slow and limited, and it's only set increase by 1.8%. And we see below inflation increases for social grants. I'm now going to turn over to my colleague who's going to present on the screen.
Thank you very much, Moko. Good afternoon, Chair, honourable members and colleagues. My name is Karen Racy, and I'm here today representing the Shonisa campaign. It is a group of 50 non-profit organizations working to combat sexual offences or sexual violence. Many of these organizations are direct service providers. Today I'd like to take an opportunity to provide you with a quick snapshot of the implications of funding cutbacks by the Department of Social Development and the withdrawal of donors from South Africa as experienced by 17 member organizations. During the period 2010 to 2013, 100 jobs were lost between these organizations, and 10 services were drastically reduced, with some services needing to be ceased completely. Some of the services stopped included 8 station-based services in Mpumalanga, a family resource center was closed in Eastern Cape, and a paralegal and family law service in Pietermaritzburg no longer exists. And where services were not stopped completely, organizations were reliant on staff taking on multiple roles and the use of volunteers or part-time staff.
These problems are further exacerbated by the Department of Social Development, sorry, the Department of Social Development's new policy on financial awards to service providers released in 2011, which states that only a percentage of salaries would be funded by the department, with the organization left to raise the rest of the money. In addition, little if any contributions are made by the department towards overhead costs for organizations. The salary scale used to determine the percentage is unclear and appears to differ from province to province. Such variance in allocation can contribute to inequality of services received by beneficiaries. The causes of underfunding are numerous and include international donors pulling out of South Africa in favor of lower income countries, payments from the National Lottery Distribution Fund considerably delayed and in cases reduced, as well as the late disbursement of funds from the Department of Social Development, and in the case of the Limpopo province, payments further delayed due to the department being placed under administration. In 2012 and 2013, the Minister of Finance acknowledged the funding difficulties and announced a range of additions to the equitable share, some of which benefit non-governmental organizations. In 2012, additions were also made to the Department of Social Development Victim Empowerment Program, which is the traditional funding source for addressing rape and domestic violence. And in 2013, additions to enable support or funding for NGOs, these developments are welcome. In 2010, the judgment in the case between Nwongo, which is the National Association of Welfare Organizations, and the Free State Department of Department of Social Development led to DSD commissioning the audit firm KPMG to cost victim empowerment services in response to the order for the revision of its funding policy. And despite commitment from Treasury upon review of the 2013 provincial budget book, not all allocated funds reached organizations, and allocation per service also varied from province to province. Furthermore, the budget allocations did not reflect the increases calculated by KPMG, which means that victim empowerment services are still underfunded. The current grant within the Division of Revenue Law for Social Development focuses on substance abuse as a priority area, with no focus on gender-based violence, which affects 1 in 4 women in South Africa and is the most common cause of post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, suicidality, disability, HIV infection, and chronic physical health problems. So with regards to the Department of Social Development, the Shukumisa campaign would like to make the following recommendations. Funding across provinces is to be standardized and equalized upwards, acknowledging that inequality in funding translates to inequality for organizations and their staff, but most importantly, inequality for potential beneficiaries. The Department of Social Development policy on funding to non-governmental organizations is to be reviewed. We cannot start from the premise of part funding, as this contributes to potential inequalities of service. Consultation with non-profit organizations is required to determine not only the funding situation, but how funds need to be spent on the ground and within the direct service. Finally, underspending and use of funds for intended purposes are to be carefully monitored, especially in the current constrained funding environment. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair, honourable members and colleagues. I'm Nevelyn Tennis. I work with the South African National AIDS Council as the manager for donor coordination. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the fiscal space for HIV and TB from the point of view of SANEC. As you know, we have a national strategic plan for HIV and TB, which articulates broad goals, objectives, and strategic interventions, and aims to inform national, provincial, district, and community-led stakeholders on strategic directions to be taken when developing implementation plans to fight HIV, AIDS, and TB. As the slide shows, the resources required to achieve the objectives of the South Africa's NSP for 2012 to 2016, the costs were estimated at 133.5 billion rand over the 5-year period. During this period, South Africa aims to screen between 15 and 25 million people for HIV and TB per year, aims to cater about 4.3 million medical male circumcisions, and increase the number of people on antiretroviral treatment from a baseline of 1.9 million at the end of 2012 to almost 4.2 million people over the 5 years. Next. As we know, South African national response to HIV and TB is multi-sectoral and requires collaborative financing arrangements. involving government, the private sector, and international partners. What I'm showing here is the number of departments which contribute significantly towards the multi-sectoral national reforms. The total investment from government is in the response increases from approximately 50.7 billion rand to 90.8 billion rand over the three-year period. You'll see that the majority of the funding comes from the Department of Health, with interventions funded at a national and provincial level. The nine provinces budget their response through the two main streams, which is the equitable share and the conditional HIV grant. And also just to note that funding from external partners, which I haven't showed in terms of numbers, but just to note that these will decrease steadily over the next 3 years. Particularly as CEPFAR, that's the US government, realigns its program to government priorities and withdraws from funding treatment facilities, and as the contraction of the global economy is solved by other bilateral partners. The total funding from external partners is expected to decrease from 4.4 billion rand in 2012-2013 to 3.7 billion rand in 2015-16. And this reflects the reduction from 20% of total funding available for the national response to 11%. So this leads me to the financial gap for HIV/AIDS and TB in South Africa. The annual financial gap between the resources required to implement the national response and the anticipated available funding is estimated to increase from 3.9 billion rand to 6.3 billion rand over the next 3 years due to the growing program costs and the contraction of external partner funding. Lastly, just a conclusion of the main point is that a lot of mention has been made, both by our President and our Health Minister, of the advances made due to this funding allocation in terms of an extension of our lifespan of South African people. So any cuts to the funding will definitely be gained. We mustn't forget that in 2012 we still had 370,000 individuals were newly infected. So we really need to meet the full cost of this NSP. However, I've shown that in 2015-16 we had a gap of 6 billion rand. And also lastly, that this NSP costing presently does not include the full cost of certain strategic objectives. The NSP has four strategic objectives. One is the structural drivers, and four is the human rights. So these particularly are not fully expressed in the costing. And then the funding for prevention is also not fully determined. So even though we have a funding gap, actually as we get more information and more evidence comes to light, the funding gap might probably even increase. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, colleagues. I'm just going to briefly speak on the Division of Revenue and Rural Health Service Division and financing in particular. I'm not going to speak to specifics about allocations to rural areas, but rather the need to change the way we allocate resources to these areas. Because of this is just a map highlighting former homelands and the division across various district municipalities and municipalities. That's just included to point to structural inequalities, and actually had another map on deprivation in rural settings that I didn't include here, which shows that deprivation and access to healthcare both relate very strongly and correlate very strongly to the borders of the former homeland. Those within those former homeland regions, deprivation is highest. And it's actually quite striking the borders, how they match deprivation and lack of access to healthcare. It speaks to geographic inaccessibility of care. This will just point to the fact that for 15% of people in rural settings that seek outpatient care, experience catastrophic expenditure per event, which means that up to 30% of their household income is used in accessing care just once. So you can imagine what that does for a household if they have more than one event in a month. It actually prevents seeking of care. So the cost of transport is a major factor that isn't considered in any division of revenue or any allocations to health. Availability of care in rural areas, there's good evidence to show that in terms of infrastructure, supply of medicines, EMS services, and healthcare professionals, there's a clear correlation between increased rurality and decrease in access to infrastructure personnel and medicines. And we can share that information with you if you'd like. Let's just speak to the burden of disease. I'm not going to go through it, but if you go back to the map of former homelands and a map of outlining based on dark zones, rural areas versus urban settings, you'll see that the burden of disease is far higher in rural areas and former homelands in South Africa than across all indicators than they are in urban areas, pointing to a high burden of disease that is not accounted for in funding mechanisms. This briefly just shows how the equitable share formula over the last 20 years has brought funding per capita to the provincial level more towards a mean for all provinces. This, however, doesn't point to equity. It points very broadly to equality and doesn't speak to rural settings. So if you start looking at actual expenditure at the provincial level, you can see that largely rural provinces spend significantly less per capita on THC as opposed to Gauteng in the Western Cape, which spend as much as 200 rand more per capita on THC, primary healthcare, than the other, and they're currently no financing mechanisms that adequately address these inequities. And this occurs within provinces too. There's no mechanism. If you look at those two dark patches in the Eastern Cape, those are the two metros. They have the highest expenditure per capita. If you look at the lighter zones, particularly Kakadu and Alfred and Zor, they are the lowest population density, considered the most rural, but have the lowest THC expenditure. So in terms of the division of revenue process, rurality is not factored in any division process. There are some proxies for backlogs and for poverty indicators, but these don't address rural factors. The equitable share formula also doesn't address the issue of division within provinces. So the provincial government, how it divides resources between urban and rural districts, which is a major challenge for rural districts and rural municipalities in addressing backlogs. And why is it important to consider rurality? Because we know that the cost of rural health and any provision of any service is higher in rural areas, and we've got evidence to show this as well. It's greater average geographic distance to access facilities, lower population densities, reducing economy scale, higher costs with HR and supply of medicines, higher burden of diseases and more complicated cases, and potentially higher costs to other areas, particularly infrastructure development. There has been a resistance from policymakers, particularly in the Department of Health, arguing for underserved rather than rural. It's the issue of absorptive capacity, again, which is used, and we've heard it today, where there's a capacity to spend, so therefore we're not going to allocate the resources needed to bring rural areas to a more equitable status in terms of their financing. But there is global movement towards universal access to provide some opportunities, and I'm just going to speak to this one last slide. Next one, so the one key recommendation would be, and I'm glad the FSC is here, is to consider resource allocation resource allocation mechanisms actually consider rurality in addition to the measures of poverty and backlog that consider things like the deprivation index, burden of disease for health-specific financing mechanisms, average distance to facilities, and the service delivery tax and costing, which again seeks norms and standards and needs to determine costs within the service, and have a factored in allocation formula at the national and provincial level within the Department of Health.
We have two presentations from an organization, the Public Service Accountability Monitor, that's based in the Eastern Cape. I will not go through their presentations for interest of time. But essentially, what we wanted to illustrate is that when we discuss the division of revenue, it has an impact on how it is that the provinces can then spend as well as local government. And we often found in assessing these discussions and the debates on these money bills is that the impact on the ground is very rarely filtered back up the system. So it's a very much a top-down budgeting system as opposed to bottom-up. And so this is really just to illustrate that there has been an impact in the way that the equitable share formula in relation to the 2011 census and the role it has had in the Eastern Cape, for example. Essentially what they're looking at here is both education and health, and that one of the key recommendations is that drawing on my colleague's recommendation around looking at rurality in the equitable share formula is that we are going to be seeing reductions in equitable share going towards the provinces that have been found to have supposedly fewer people but might actually have a higher disease burden, for example, in the Eastern Cape where you have a very young population, a very old population, and a middle population that's often sick because they've either had to leave their work and come back into the rural areas. And so the cost of providing services is actually higher and doesn't warrant necessarily a reduction in their equitable share. Again, this is seen in when one looks at education as well, that again, there's been a decrease in the Eastern Cape and Southern Natal, as you see as a comparison, as a result of reduced enrollment numbers based on the 2011 census. And this is going to have an impact on the ability of more rural municipalities or districts to be able to deliver acceptable services of an acceptable level. Then an organization, the Studies in Poverty and Inequality Institute, that are based in Johannesburg, have also provided an input on housing and the Department of Human Settlement. And what I want to draw attention to, is the recommendations coming after that. And again, this provides you with some additional information from the SABRA presentation and the FSC. Sorry, I just want to make sure I get the way it needs to be. So we've seen that when one looks at the human settlement development grant, when inflation is factored in, real allocations in 2019 and 2012-13 declined drastically, and we've heard some reasons already this morning for why this is the case. And that this decrease in spending is going to have an impact in whether there has been proper evaluation of the province's ability to spend, but also if we're going to create a new grant as discussed this morning, how can we counter for increasing capacity to deliver on this key priority area. So essentially from their analysis of the Division of Revenue Bill, when looking specifically at the national, provincial and local government allocations towards housing, is that there's still a massive under-delivery on houses, and this raises important questions which need to be answered when looking at the Division of Revenue Bill about what is the nature of this expenditure. If housing backlog exists, so we need a comprehensive review, but also how is the money currently being spent. So the recommendations are that when looking at allocations, they need to take into account the effects of inflation and need to factor in the capacity of provincial and municipal governments, which have been discussed at least this morning. And the Urban Settlement Development Grant, today the USDG has not been used appropriately by the Metro. It's still being spent on the enhanced sustainability of human settlements. It is mainly being spent on, for example, roads and bridges. And so again, this calls for a thorough review of these various allocations towards the priority. The recommendation, drawing on the FSC's recommendation, is that the Rural Household Infrastructure Grant needs to be reviewed to make it more flexible and cost effective. And emergency accommodation, municipalities have failed to provide and implement proactive, programmatic, and coherent response to evictions and the provision of alternative accommodations. So again, we need to see if there's some component in the way that these ones are put together. In terms of the question on backyarders and how do we pay for that at a policy level and within the Division of Revenue, is that currently there is a lack of national policy subsidy instruments that cater for the demand of low-income rental accommodation. And there's a need for public-funded rental housing targeting those that earn low $3,200 per month who are currently not targeted by social housing programs. And this would require capital spending as well as the development of an operating strategy to ensure management and maintenance of the rental housing as it currently exists. So this really speaks to trying to cater for a more innovative way of providing housing to South Africans. There appears, and we've heard it again this morning, poor coordination between different spheres of government, and this often makes it very difficult for communities to know who they should be speaking to. And this also raises concerns around direct and indirect ones, because then it makes it harder for communities to know which sphere of government is responsible for delivering that service at any given point. And then how do you, if you live in a rural area, get to the national department to ask questions about the delivery of a particular grant. Again, there needs to be factored into the allocation a need to develop functioning monitoring systems for verification of housing projects, and this is drawn on the FFP recommendation of 2013. And we need to have accessible data on financial and non-financial performance indicators. Currently, these are absent and or not clear or measurable. And the situation at the provincial level is worse. So this then, of course, impacts on that question around the budget ceilings, if it's a rule of thumb, what are they basing the adequacy of those allegations at the national, provincial, and local level. So lastly, this is something that the Budget and Expenditure Monitoring Forum, to finish up our presentation, feel quite strongly about, and getting greater engagement by civil society in these processes, is that we do need to review how we develop our national, provincial, and local budgets, in particular building in a mechanism for greater community voice in these allocations. We need to implement gender-responsive planning and budgeting, as our colleagues from Tribunica have highlighted, that if we're not producing a gender-responsive framework, then it's unlikely that we're going to address the specifics within the various sectors. To facilitate real participation and engagement in the budget process, from the neighborhood ward district to the province to national government. And we heard a question this morning about what is the role of the IDPs. And many of the communities that we speak to have felt that there doesn't seem to be alignment between what's contained in the IDP at the local government level in terms of delivery. But again, if you see the whole framework of the Division of Revenue Bill, and if it's constraining the ability of provinces to deliver or local governments, then you need to come back to specific macroeconomic questions. We need to support greater transparency and access to budget information at provincial and local levels, and this would be even for the Division of Revenue Bill, to make it accessible and readable for communities to understand what is coming their way. Thank you.
Thank you very much, ma'am. Our members, the questions on our disappear.
Chairperson, we welcome this presentation. Just a question, do you do presentations at provincial legislators as well?
Thank you, but yeah, I think this comment, I think one has to note the NGOs represent, or the extension of NGOs is called solidarity. The NGOs existence is rather than, could be even seen as an extension of government service that they initiate people. I think a comment that was made in the review of funding is important in terms of historically what happened to two NGOs being very fundamental in service delivery on behalf of government, and both of them are struggling and trying to be close. I think this presentation, you must note the comments made, but I think there will be more work to be done in the new term of office. And I think a workshop or an engagement right up front with all the stakeholders will probably be welcome to them. Thanks.
Oh, thank you, sir. my suggestion is on the issue of the budget deficit. I'm not going to commit ever, but I don't find out in your view, I think 8% is not that much, 8% of the GDP is not that much, no, increase compared to the US and other countries that have a big budget deficit. What do you think is the reasonable budget deficit that countries can afford? My second question is on the issue on page 6. The increase of social grants. The USF has pushed out the social grants to parents and the like. I'd like to find out what you think. Do you think that will be sustainable if you say social grants are not enough? Do you suspect that the USF and notion that they have the social grants? On the issue of solar funding, more a question or comment than that. There are many on the automation of the gas that is going to increase due to the fall of solar internationally. But there's an EU resolution that the countries that EU views as developing and are now in the process of making their own revenue. The EU is now withdrawing 48 of the assistance. Now, are you aware of those developments in the donor countries, especially EU? And do you think that South Africa should then come in to question the blow because the fund donor fund is being withdrawn by the EU countries? How do you go to sustain this? Funding. We've got our own trust fund, sort of development assistance that we do help in other countries. Do you think that should be directed to within the country? Deficit funding in provinces, or different funding in provinces, Jefferson said that some provinces are funding some projects, especially. Jefferson on this finding, one project is more than the Eastern Cape. But as far as you know, the issue of rape are concerned, I think that was the issue in of rape or sexual offences. Don't you think that is perhaps the incident driven? If there are more incidents of rape or sexual offences in the province, obviously find more the police finding all those. I don't think perhaps that's the issue of those issues, Chairperson of funding. I have a couple of questions, Chairperson, but I'll limit time to talk.
You may respond. I also want my clarity would be also around how often does your institution's organization interact with relevant departments? Because some of the issues that we are reading are quite important, and one would think that you should have long started engaging with those departments, but I'm not too sure as to what extent that happened. And your participation in parliamentary public hearing, because in this case is the first time to get you before us, but I would imagine that the parliament throughout the year could have a lot of public hearings, and some of your interests could be well attended to in some of those, because they would need much more time to engage. I just want to check as to what extent do you use this one opportunity to engage them?
Thank you, Honourable Members. Some of the questions I'm going to ask my colleagues to respond to. But just to confirm that we have, and we do, through our various members, make a presentation to provincial legislators. So the presentation that you saw around the Eastern Cape will be made to the Eastern Cape legislature as well, with the Public Service Accountability Monitor. And it's been our experience for those of us that have been working in or undertaking budget advocacy and budget advocacy work that it always gets sent back up to the national level, because often the provinces will say they don't have enough money, and so we need to go back to the question of why don't they have enough money, which then brings us back to this forum to ask the bigger questions about the division of revenue but also the macroeconomic framework. So that's kind of, we're trying to engage at many levels. currently we don't do that much work at local government level, but essentially we're working primarily at provincial and national. I think there was a question around the, or comment on the, on kind of affirming that many NGOs, particularly when looking at social services, are an extension of government, and we are deeply concerned about the cuts in funding towards these key services, and I'll hand over to my colleague to say a bit more. Thank you very much for your questions and comments. Just to firstly address the question about the incidents, whether that determines the amount spent on something like sexual offences or rape. When I spoke about the difference in the way activities are funded, it's more fundamental in terms of in one province a shelter will be fully funded per woman that stays in the shelter. In another province, only a percentage of the operational costs will be funded. So I think that's where the disparity comes in, not necessarily in terms of incident rates. Then in terms of the funding cuts, I think we've really seen in terms of the services that need to be delivered and the new funding model within the Department of Social Development, we've seen a lot more focus be placed on activities and outcomes as opposed to operational expenditure of the organization. So we are receiving, as service organizations, we're receiving increasing targets for the number of people to be reached within the mandate of the Department of Social Development, but we're not being funded for the resources to actually carry out those activities. So as organizations, we're left to really find that money ourselves in order to operate, rather than just do the work.
There was a question on the deficit and what we would consider a reasonable deficit. We did make a more detailed input on this to the joint sitting on finance, and I'll be happy to go to make another presentation in more detail on this. But essentially what we are trying to show is that there are opportunities for increasing our deficit, particularly if we consider where we borrow from, so making sure that we're borrowing more from domestic funds at regulated interest rates. So part of the dynamic has been that if we are borrowing externally, that also makes us more vulnerable to external kind of credit rating agencies and kind of really at a whim of investors that don't necessarily even live in South Africa, and the impact of their speculation or gambling, so to speak, has a direct result on South Africa's ability to be sovereign in its ability to raise funds and deliver services. So essentially what our presentation and in our alternative budget speech is saying is that that you could have, if it is, and historically there has been good evidence of this, that with greater domestic borrowing and a greater role for the state to deliver services, you're more likely to see growth. But we can have that debate, and I would be very happy to include my colleagues from the Progressive Economic Network that have done quite a lot of work on this to provide more information to this committee on the alternatives that's been currently presented. So I'm not going to speak necessarily to what would be a reasonable budget deficit, because there would be, you need to have a number of kind of reviews around our regulatory framework for our interest rates, the way in which we borrow, and yeah, essentially our recommendation is that we need to review this in such a way that we're not putting South Africa, the government and the economy at the mercy of international risk-taking for that question. In terms of the social grants, there are some forum members who have called for a basic income grant, so kind of speaking a little bit to the EFF's call, but essentially the question that around sustainability, I often feel and believe sets up this kind of zero-sum game. It's either no comprehensive social protection system
or we leave it to the trickle-down effect of this imaginary market that's going to suddenly uplift everybody. Eventually, we're always going to have old people, we're always going to have young people, people are going to die. We need a social protection system that provides support for those that fall out of the economy. Having said that, South Africa has a huge burden and has a long-standing legacy that has to be addressed. And our current macroeconomic policies and the trickle-down effect has not happened. We have one of the highest inequalities in the world, and we need to address this. And one of the ways that we can do that is by pumping money into these economies, into local economies within neighborhoods. And one way, and there's some evidence to show that by providing a basic income grant, by virtue, the only means test would be that you are a citizen of South Africa, then inject funds into local neighborhoods and provide a local system of economic generation and revenue. So currently, many of our poor communities are purchasing goods. That money isn't circulating back in that neighborhood. It's going up with sort of having to purchase goods from other areas. And so there isn't enough sort of local sort of economic growth. And one mechanism could be to use the basic income grant. So the sustainability question is really, if we want to review our comprehensive social protection system, which has to be in place by virtue of the human and the constitution, but also we need to look more broadly at questioning these assumptions around the trickle-down effect. And what we would argue is that we need a more active state than is currently being proposed in the macroeconomic framework, and as we see reflected in the division of revenue bill, with provinces seeing reductions in their allocations and equitable share, and then that then has trickle down effect on the ability to deliver services on the ground. In terms of overseas development, this is something that we haven't as yet started engaging with directly, but I will ask my colleagues to make comments on it. But essentially, there are a number of international campaigns that are focusing on making sure that there is a fair system in place, because South Africa is part of a global economy, and given the role that South Africa plays regionally, yes, we should be supporting our partners. So I think in terms of systems, again, that would need to be a fairly comprehensive assessment made. But one of the things that we value in South African system and in terms of our budget system is that all overseas development or needs to be put on budget, and so we can see what is available, and also we can see where it's been reduced. So this enables us to make the right kinds of recommendations around innovative financing. And it speaks to direct versus indirect funding at an international level. But I'll hand over to my colleagues to speak.
I think let's talk about what we have been doing, and that is that SADC has certainly been pushing back to some of these funders to say that actually this is the information, this is what will be the effect of your withdrawal, and challenging that. And in fact, for example, with the US government, we actually did get them to agree to not be treated the same at the initial rate that they had anticipated. So there is a bit of pushback. I think SADC is working with various government departments, is assisting government departments to cost their plans, to understand how much it costs to really make a difference to implement the HIV/AIDS and TB strategies, and participating both at provincial and national level. We have a provincial AIDS council, we have development funders, but quite a few stakeholders, by nature of fact, that they represent government and non-government involved in our various structures. So we are bringing people together. I think your last question about should South Africa stop supporting others and redirect the funding, I think we need to look at it more holistically. I think that you can't say that South Africa doesn't have to support others, but I think that we need to be aware of the effect of the HIV and TB epidemic, and we need to make real choices about how we spend our money. And through their extraction, we're providing a framework for those discussions, for prioritization, for costing. Part of my job is to make sure that there is no double funding between external donors and government, and enhancing the working together to make sure that we have efficiency.
And then just the last question around engagement with stakeholders and different government partners. As the forum, we have been engaging primarily with the health departments and basic education in Limpopo, and the work that our colleagues are doing in the various provinces where they are situated. Essentially, part of my job has been to now look over the 5-6 years of work that BEMF has been doing, but even before that, that there is a need for civil society groups that are focusing on budget or trying to have an impact on or provide useful information around delivery of services. It always comes back to money question. And so part of our role as BEMF, as we see it, is to provide opportunities to allow for organizations to engage in the budget process, be able to understand what these broader questions around the division of revenue have for the delivery of services, for example, for NGOs wanting to support programs around gender-based violence and so forth. We would very much welcome the opportunity to in May or post the elections when you again sit on this particular budget, 2014-15 in the framework, to have an open forum where we can bring our partners and we can sit with Parliament, given your powers over money bills and member bills, to have a broader national discussion around budgeting in line with our constitution. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, you are more than welcome to engage with us here in the Parliament. But I think you should consider seriously engaging with national departments as opposed to provincial departments. Because you see the budgetary process starts a long time before it reaches this stage. So if you really want to look or influence a certain direction, it will be wise to begin to engage with those departments at that level, because as you're quite aware, money is allocated from national revenue funds down to provinces. So they will always send it back to national. But if you come into national, I would advise that you start set in terms of engaging those departments, social development, health, and so on and so forth, basic education, and whatever department. So that by the time you come to this level, at least you have covered a lot of ground and some. You would have succeeded with some other form of lobbying and influencing in terms of policy direction. But thank you very much. On the money bills and other related, we are more than ready. We'd love to engage on that so that we see how do we improve in moving forward. Because, like I said, some of the things that you are missing, but we'll hopefully consider them in our report. The only Parliament last year for the fiscal framework, so unfortunately at this time we won't be able to tender with it. But we could see what you do in terms of our recommendations. So that is it on our members with regard to the BNF presentation. And thank you very much to all the team, and hope to engage with you further in the future. That is if we are still here, some of us. Some are coming back, of course, some won't be here. And the constitutional committee could be at different people altogether. But at least the committee will still be there to engage with you. No. If that happens, you're also more than welcome. We'd love to.
Thank you very much. Honourable members, I think we'll now move to item consideration of minutes. Only one set of minutes, three pages. The minutes of the 12th of March. And I have a move on the second hour. I'm going to be able to move.
much. The next item, the last, is the legal report. I'm not sure if you've got Emma. Yes. That is the last item on this. You don't have. Okay, we can deal with it tomorrow. It's not a big deal. Can we deal with it tomorrow then? Okay? Thank you very much, honorable member. And that brings us to the end of this meeting. I thank you very much, Jane.
So, I just want to sensitize members. Tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock, the State Commission of Finance will meet regarding two reports on the provincial treasury spending. It will be, as we circulated yesterday, please listen to it. And then tomorrow afternoon, Chairperson, begin the preparations of the finance on the mandates. Good afternoon. Yes. The notices have been circulated just to give your secretary's leave.
Thank you. Thank you. That was the announcement. The meeting was attended. I thank you very much.
I'm going to go to the next one.